In the game of the Cabal, to be served up as a sacrifice for their alleged sins of existing and not having enough willingness to obsequiously bow before the Jews, or if other forces are working with whites in overcoming the tyranny of the Jewish system, is indeed a question. One can conclude, however, that the Jews are now desperately attempting to accelerate this agenda and bring about a race war, as the CIA operative Charles Manson had intended through his acting out the murder of Sharon Tate, the real-life parallel of the Hollywood film Rosemary's Baby, superintended by Anton LaVey and financed by the Vatican, to bring about a race war in which the whites would be killed by the blacks. James Mason today espouses Christian identity, no longer with any reservation, and is still a staunch proponent of Manson as a harbinger of universal order, through attempting to invert the intentions of the latter in bringing about a helter-skelter, having sponsored and created the Atomwaffen, yet another incarnation of a small cell of lone wolf domestic terrorists, freedom fighters, to create more episodes of the theater of the real. This, in conjunction with myriad other figures such as Brandon Tarrant, Dylan Roof, Anders Breivik, etc., all become associated with a constellation of ideas related to white people and whatever Jews dislike or look upon as a threat to their power and wish to associate in the mass consciousness with terrorism, foreign and domestic. The scapegoat, the white man, and whites in general are being led to the slaughter in the theater of the real, while the Jews hide behind their police state and create conditions which, as in the case of the Palestinians in the State of Israel, make it impossible to exist and qualify as acts of genocide by UN definition. Backed into a corner both legislatively and physically in terms of territorial invasion by non-white foreigners, as the whites will have no choice but to play their role in the theater of the real. Whether the final act is one of tragedy or triumph will depend on themselves. References: Philosophical Metapolitical Conception of Practical Idealism, Simulacra and Simulations, Jean Baudrillard, Secret Societies and Psychological Warfare, Michael Hoffman, Pawns in the Game, William Guy Carr, The Decline of the West, Oswald Spengler, False Flags, Anatomy of a False Flag, Ole Damgaard, Chronicles of False Flag Terror, A European Perspective, Nicholas Colostrum, Ph.D. Political Theater in Charlottesville, and Nobody Died in Boston, Either State-Sponsored Terrorism with Hollywood Special Effects, James Fetzer, Ph.D. False Flags Unfurled, https://rents.com General 76 FlarGD.htm Primary Sources of White Terrorists, Letters of a Klansman, Louis Beam Deceived, Damned and Defiant, David Lane Siege, James Mason A Practical Guide to Strategy and Tactics and Revolution, David Myatt National Socialism, Yesterday and Today, William the White, Theater of the Real, The Russian Question Index, The Russian Question, Dugin and Eurasianism, The Slav, The Russian Question, Their Exits, Claims of an Apparent False Association between Pro-White Activism and Russia Geopolitically, or perhaps it would be better said Biopolitically. This apparent false association will be critically examined in the foregoing, and a provisional stance on the issue propounded as to whether it is indeed false or no. The basis of this association between pro-whites and Russia lies in the tangibly obvious connection between the ethnocentrism which naturally leads peoples to favor their own, which exists in all people, and the biological similarity between Russians who, though incorporative of Asiatic elements to varying degrees, are conventionally referred to as white, and who presumably would look upon themselves as predominantly white, though constituting a relatively distinct type to their Western, more pure Aryan counterpart, the Nordico-Germanic. This biological basis for creating an association between whites in the Western countries of continental Europe and its historical allies and Russia thus would be readily accepted by most as a viable basis for geopolitical affiliation. The biopolitical underpins the geopolitical in the minds of all, if only at a near level of consciousness, and this even in spite of the political correctness agenda of anti-racism. Perhaps this is the reason, this recognition of biological reality, that the Jews and their lackeys have vilified Russia as a Nazi regime on innumerable occasions, projecting their own irrational anti-racist biases upon Russia, and this as a means of prejudicially condemning Russia and its politics. Hence at least an appearance of fear and trembling on the part of Jewry is put forth in their media and transmitted as an appearance of fear on the part of the good citizens, the Jews pretend to be. This is the standard operating procedure of Jewry in their vilification of others, inciting violence against them and using their pawns to do their dirty work, playing both ends against the middle, dividing and conquering the Egyptians as their template for tyranny the Old Testament speaks of. Hence an association with negativity is to all appearances created in the Jewish media, and Russia is painted with a black brush. This could be intentionally undergone on the part of Jewry as a means of setting up the stage for the World War III apocalypse of biblical prophecy, using Russia as its boogeyman, playing the role of Gog or Magog, and dialectically playing both China and Russia against NATO, the so-called Christians against the Satanists or Antichrists, according to various interpretations of their Bible blueprint. For the Russians themselves, the Jews who live there have their own brand of eschatological propaganda, and this embodies itself in the Orthodox Church, the continuation of the Byzantine Empire which they had been attempting to recreate since its implosion in the Cloaca Gentium of what is now Turkey. The influence of Jewry in all nations is a factor not to be denied or diminished, as can be easily concluded from a basic scattershot statistical overview of who controls what and to what extent. With respect to Russia, the writer has heard that approximately 80% of the oligarchs are Jewish. However, this does not mean, just as the case of England with its Jewish banksters, that Russia or England are totally Jew-controlled and that there is no opposition when there most assuredly is. This is the main question: to what extent does Russia as a nation-state and those in control of its apparatus of power have control in opposition to the Zionist globalist agenda of mongrelization and the erasure of the organic differences of peoples and cultures? This is not possible to definitively conclude, and one can only look through a glass darkly. However, one can also gain greater insight looking through this glass with the torchlight shone upon it by some of the most significant racialist theorists on the Russian question known to the writer, which will be discussed in the following. The National Socialists had factions in Russia and perhaps faced the greatest opposition to the triumph of the swastika in that region of the earth. Stalin also apparently had a party in Germany at some point and was, in spite of any political rhetorical smokescreen to the contrary, ethnically Russian at heart. The claim that his name derived from son of a Jew in the Ossetian language of Georgia is apparently false, and thus his racial bill of health can be cleared of the Jewish tumor. Kerry Bolton, an alt-right spin doctor, for however legitimate his work and however much it amounts to distortion, had written a book on Stalin entitled Stalin, The Enduring Legacy, in addition to another on the relationship between Stalin and Germany and Stalin's party there, and this provides some insight into the ethnically oriented nature of Stalin, although it exists in cryptic form, not so explicit as in the case of the National Socialists. Hence Stalin, who was assassinated by a Jewish doctor and who facilitated the disempowerment of Jewry in the Soviet Union, having Trotsky assassinated in Mexico, was to all appearances motivated by his Russian soul to oppose the pestilential miasma from the East, the Jew. This is not certain, but the writer speculates that the Russian folk soul manifested itself through these circumstances surrounding Stalin's regime and his political praxis. National Socialists were quite clearly anti-Russian in the main, though certain elements wanted a pact with them. The official policy of the National Socialists with respect to Russia and the Soviet Union's population in large part was that they were untermenschen, laboring under the whip hand of the Jew. They were indeed laboring under the whip hand, although to stigmatize them as untermenschen is unfair, and this was a flaw of National Socialist policy, though Hitler undoubtedly had his reasons, perhaps more opposing the ideology of Bolshevism and its Jewish purveyors than Russian people as an ethnic stock. Apparently National Socialists from Russia had gone to Germany when that was feasible before the beginning of the Second World War, forming some form of alliance with the National Socialists. The Ukrainians under Stepan Bandera were affiliated with the National Socialists and thus, though ethnically Slavic or Dinaric, were nonetheless viewed in a favorable light by Hitler and his affiliates, at least to some extent. That Alfred Rosenberg was from a country bordering Russia, though of Baltic stock, further underscores that the National Socialists gave priority to a racial, not a nationalistic worldview, as borders could always be rearranged and inevitably and invariably are with the natural inclination of each people for expansion as an expression of their will to power. The attempt on the part of Germany to retake Poland illustrates this point, as does the previous de facto colonization of parts of Russia under Tsardom. The antagonism between the Germans who colonized Russia and the Russian peasants is clearly seen in the rebellion of Pugachev as the archetypical representation of the Russian soul against the Germanizing influence. The hostility toward the German and Polish nobility by the Russian peasants was largely a reaction to the disdainful treatment they received at the hands of their would-be masters, and their would-be masters' karma played itself out in the subsequent revolutions whose flames were fanned by the Eternal Jew and his usury and exploit. Hence the relations between Russians and Germans were always strained, and this owing to the divergence of biology and culture, and this in spite of the similarities existent, the Russians being a somewhat hybridized stock, more German than Asiatic but with varying degrees of Asiatic admixture, creating a somewhat tempestuous persona in the type. Regardless, the differences existent between the two served and still serves as a basis for camaraderie on an ethnic and thus on a political basis, if and only if the political platform of the nation states is biopolitical, which is indeed the question. It is to all appearance not the case with the so-called Judaized Western powers of Western Europe and their Anglo-American affiliates, whose policies are obviously contrary to the survival of their founding ethnic stock. The question remains: is Russia a nation-state that has any racially based policies buried under the rhetoric of politics it may clothe itself in? The surfeit of Jews surrounding its contemporary leadership does not give a negative answer, as this does not argue for total power concentrated in the hands of Jewry. Rather, it simply demonstrates the influence of the Jewish occupation government system and the necessity of its accommodation by the indigenous people in order to avoid being placed in the crosshairs of the United Nations as a Nazi state, i.e. one having an ethnic and organic basis. Hence the rhetoric of political correctness, which might be called raceless indifferentism, the necessity to adopt an attitude of anti-racism, i.e. denial of the existence and value of race, is an obligation imposed upon all nation-states under the current crisis of the modern world of the J.O.G. mongrelization agenda. This raceless indifferentism is reflected by the leading ideologues of Russia and the top man Putin, with Putin making explicit reference to caveman nationalism, and the ideologue Alexander Dugin condemning Atlanticism and whites being affiliated with this as imperialists without making any mention of Jewry. Perhaps either or both are simply echoing the tune of the political Pied Pipers of Zion as a means of putting forth a general strategy of concealment, subtly forcing the issue of aggression against the Western powers and specifically the USA, while assisting to undermine its Protestant Zionist culture with the degenerative culture of liberalism, funding subversive movements like BLM and others. Perhaps this is simply a means of pulling off the band-aid of Protestantism from the wound of Semitic gangrene, which has and continues to eat away at the once robust flesh of the ethnic stock who created the West. Who can say? One can see that this agenda appears to facilitate the Jews' plans for white genocide, however, and that Putin's policy of enabling non-white foreigners to gain citizenship in Russia appears to suggest agreement with this plan. However, perhaps this is simply another strategy of accommodation which gets the Jew off his back so he can make more significant moves later in the geopolitical chess game. Various disinformation agents and Zionist apologists such as Brandon Martinez and Kyle Hunt of Renegade Broadcasting have vilified Putin in the recent years and Russia as a whole as an anti-white figure for acts such as enabling the murder of the National Socialist Dzhak in jail, but these might also be political stunts for all we can see through Western eyes. The stance of these disinfo agents, however, are countered by still other disinfo agents such as Nick Fuentes, a Mexican-American crypto-Jew, and E. Michael Jones, a Tradcat Sedevantist Catholic, who both simply wish to assimilate whites into their Christian Catholic agenda and assimilate them into the cloaca gentium of the Church spiritual Israel. Hence either interpretation is untrustworthy, and one can ultimately only make sense of geopolitics through observation of actions, not words, and this leaves the question of Russia unanswered, as to whether it can in any way accommodate any ethnic orientation as a bastion of racial preservation of the ethnic Russian stock, let alone that of the West, code speak in some mouths for Aryans. Julia Savola, in his Revolt Against the Modern World, had concluded his work addressing the issue of Russia as typifying the end of the cycle of the Manvantara, the depth of the Kali Yuga or Age of Lead, and its mass man of Homo Sovieticus. He affirms that this is the region wherein the Fourth Estate triumphed and that the mass man can be seen to manifest in all of his collectivistic tendencies and subpersonality within this Soviet crucible. This degeneracy is clearly the influence of Sovietism, but Russia is not strictly correlated with Sovietism, as the case of Stalin illustrates, with the cultural organic foundation of Russia breaking through the iron bonds of the Jewish mechanized state form and resurrecting itself as a hero, if only within the confines of Sovietism. At that time, not something that could have been thrown off owing to the Jewish influence, and which was pragmatically useful in a Russian expansionism under the uniform of the proletarian worker. This might have been, and to this day may still be, a means of riding the tiger of modernity within modernity in its lowest state, that of the Fourth Estate or caste of the serfs. Perhaps Stalin was the avatar of the Russian folk soul who initiated the transmutation of the Russian soul from the base metal of Sovietism to the philosophical gold of empire. This is a question which has no definitive answer to those not initiated into its secrets. What can be inferred, however, is that Russia, being Aryan to a certain proportion, has always had an ethnic consciousness, and that like any organism it simply had to adapt itself to the changing circumstances of the modern world and its disintegrative influence on the cultural organisms that bear the name race today. James Lerett Battersby, an English National Socialist, wrote the book The Holy Book of Adolf Hitler in two parts, and in this work he speaks of how the future world order will be an Aryan order, with Japan holding down the fort in Far East Asia, Russia having hegemony over the eastern part of the empire, and Germany over the west, with the capital of both being located at the border, presumably in Danzig, and the spiritual capital being located in India, the ancient Aryan homeland. In the work's conclusion, Battersby lists quotations of National Socialists who were martyred in Nuremberg, which prognosticatively reveal the karmic consequences of the war of allied aggression and the intended destruction of Aryan mankind on the part of Jewry, and the role of Russia in what Hans Fritzsche in his last words called the beginning of the Hitler legend initiated with their sacrifice for the National Socialist idea. Alfred Rosenberg's comment, "I don't blame the Russians at all for trying to break the stranglehold of this clerical monster. I have always been anti-Catholic," illustrates the ideological sympathy between National Socialism and Russia, at least in its anti-Judeo-Catholic form. Hermann Göring said during the Nuremberg trials, "Germany must try either with the English or the Russians." Given that England had caused the decay and rot of its own empire largely through the presence of Jewry, but not exclusively, in large part through adhering to its false idea of egalitarianism and hypocritical pacifism it had clung to, it was hence with Russia and looking toward the east that Germany would again arise. Rudolf Hess, quoted in the same work during the Nuremberg trials, prophesied the rise of Germany from the ashes, when America and Russia have exhausted themselves in war. These prophetic words are manifesting in the geopolitical crises of the time of this writing, as Germany bides its time for heroic resurrection. Whether the Russia which remains will align with Germany according to the Holy Book of Adolf Hitler of Battersby is a question. Many critical and downright cynical types have attempted to venture a prediction that the Kalergi plan would be facilitated by Russia and Europe, with the removal of NATO's ostensive protection would be at the mercy of the Mad Ruskies and Chinese hordes. That it would be an effective means to decimate Europe, to orchestrate war between Russia and America, and serve Europe up as a sacrifice in the process of acting out biblical prophecy with, as Albert Pike spoke of in his letter to Giuseppe Mazzini, the victory going to the political Zionists. Battersby, in his The Holy Book of Adolf Hitler, speaks of a world plan for peace which would be a product of the reconciliation of Russia and Germany under a template of virile nationalism, rather than the decadent democracies which are currently rotting the healthy population from within. They would form a world peace plan isolating America and creating regional blocs similar to the Kalergi plan and that of Alexander Dugin's The Fourth Political Theory, only with the nation-states not being comprised of rootless internationalist individuals as in the Kalergi plan, but organic racial collectives in the traditionalist sense of blood and soil and culture being a resultant product of the combination of the two, presumably formed by and deriving from the higher planes. Hence, according to the prognostication of Battersby, who was almost certainly an insider, the future world would be a world union of national socialists. Whether this would entail the devastation of Russia played off against America in a Third World War is uncertain, and whether the current leadership of Russia would be redeemable is also uncertain. Francis Parker Yockey, in his work The Enemy of Europe and to some extent in his magnum opus Imperium, contends that the culture-destroying influence of Americanism, that is to say Zionist liberal ideology and culture, poses a greater threat to Europe than Russia, and thus that Russia should be aligned within destroying the Western democratic regimes. He argues that the subtle disintegrative influence of the former far outstrips the latter, although he doesn't embrace either the capitalist or the communist ideology of New York or Moscow. Rather, he contended that the then-current communist regime prevailing in Russia could be transmuted into something more similar to National Socialism. This has been to all appearances borne out in recent times since the rise of Stalin and the nationalization of Russia and its projection imperialistically over the globe. However, a criticism of this might be that the spread of Sovietism globally was always undergone under the instrumentality of Jewry, and that Jewry was always in control. This is uncertain, and both points may be valid: the ethnic culture of Russia warring in an occult fashion with the architecture and ideological garb of Sovietism, of Jewish design. A transmutation of this coarse, materialistic worldview, however, seems to have transpired since the end of the influence of Trotsky, perhaps, and increasingly so as the parasite of Jewry was all but excreted from the Russian bowels up to the rule of Putin. Hence Yockey was right, as can be seen in the comparatively degenerate and debased condition of the West and the ascension in the East of the cultural son of Russia from the darkness of its communist past, the soul of the Russian having slumbered under the Iron Curtain, in hibernation to muster its strength in the Negredo phase of the Manwantara and to come out of hibernation as the Arctus bear of first Hyperborea. Yockey was apparently courting ties with Muslims as well as communists in Cuba to strike against America, perhaps before he was presumably assassinated after his apprehension. Yockey's ties might raise eyebrows amongst the purists, especially the Nordicists of our movement, but the phrase "the enemy of my enemy is my friend" bears the ring of truth. After all, Hitler had many non-white allies, not only India, Iraq, Iran, Colombia, Venezuela, Thailand, Tibet, etc., but many other nations throughout the globe. The idea of National Socialism being racial nationalism, blood and soil, is not the property of blue-eyed, blonde-haired Nordics, but need not exclude those closest to the Hyperborean Divias either. The Russian Federation of today accommodates and includes ethnic groups who Yockey had courted during his endeavors, as well as to some extent Adolf Hitler. Nonetheless, its anti-Atlanticist rhetoric emanating from the ideologue Dugin, who according to rumor was and is under the influence of Evgeny Primakov aka Evgeny Finkelstein, a Jewish ideologue, is either a smokescreen to conceal its actual ethnocentrism or a genuine expression of its antipathy toward the West along racialist lines. That Yockey epitomized Atlanticism and that Atlanticism is castigated by modern Russia creates further confusion as to whether Russia is in any way consistent with Aryan ethnocentrism. The answer can only be said that the Russian soul is ethnocentrically Russian, and that the state form of modern Russia under Putin is most likely an attempt at a representation or resurrection of the Byzantine multi-ethnic empire under a certain label, the Russian Federation. However, perhaps greater transmutation of this intended state and ethnic form is underway and will reconcile its contradictions through the conflict to come. According to the words of David Lane in his fictional work KD Rebel, in the last chapter from Russia with Love, he plays out a fictional scenario of how pro-white forces in Ukraine and Russia will take down the leadership inside of both countries and transform them into pro-white or ethnically Aryan states through the dialectic of the Third World War. This may be prognosticative, assuming David Lane was who he is reputed to have been, an initiate. This may be a further development of a world plan by Aryan adepts. William L. Pierce, founder of the National Alliance and writer of Hunter and the Turner Diaries, has the latter work end on a similar note, with America being struck with nukes by Russia assisting in the destruction of the system from within. Perhaps this is predictive programming on the part of the Aryan elites revealing what their intentions are. This is not entirely clear to the writer. William L. Pierce was affiliated with Russian women as far as the writer has heard, so this might suggest another point in favor of this thesis. Some of his American dissident voices broadcasts revealed the Jewish organization or Russian mafia in its true light, as well as defending Russia and East European women who were and are being abducted by Jewish and Israeli sex traffickers and being relocated to the prison state of Israel. David Duke also has had connections with Russia. However, the critical question a cynic would venture is whether this is simply designed to create the appearance of an affiliation between Russia and pro-whites in the West, or if it is an authentic connection. The writer speculates an organic connection exists, but not necessarily the nation-state or political regime itself. He can only view the world through Western eyes, living in the matrix of Zion. In the work Gold in the Furnace, Savitri Devi asked a National Socialist insider in Germany whether Russians were on their side, and she received an affirmative reply that they were, and seemed convinced that was the case. Battersby's The Holy Book of Adolf Hitler is what Dugin would call an Atlanticist work, hearkening to the mythos of the Atlantean origins of the Aryan race and its implied originary influence on subsequent regions of the earth and implied supremacy, the back-to-origins position of such as H.S. Chamberlain. However, in that work Battersby defines Aryan as comprised of the stock of Nordic, Germanic, Celtic and Slavic stock who would form the rulership of the New World Order in a new golden age of the Satya Yuga. The Slavic element of this conception is a sort of wild card in the minds of some taking the position that Russians are not entirely or adequately white Aryan, and others the converse. Dugin's conception of world history draws heavily upon the National Socialist Annan Eber member Hermann Wirth, while simultaneously condemning National Socialism as Atlanticism, caveman nationalism. This wild card of the Russian soul, with its inner restlessness and Icarianism, its lyrical soulfulness, is a question indeed that one must come to understand in order to decide what must be done in coming to an answer to the Russian question. Dugin and Eurasianism. The figure of Alexander Dugin, the main proponent of contemporary Eurasianism as expressed in his work The Fourth Political Theory and other related works, is another upon initial encounter ambiguous figure who has another unique philosophical offering for those seeking alternatives to the modern world. Dugin holds himself out as a so-called traditionalist in the mode of a navola or Ganon, only qualified to a great degree, claiming in his critique of Ganon's notion of tradition and the counter-initiation, in which only major religions and Freemasonry qualified as legitimate traditions as they are based upon historical transmission of initiation, which is his criterion of what constitutes a tradition properly so-called, that Ganon's criteria is wrong, and that Dugin's conception of Noumenorrhea is a valid traditionalist perspective. Of course, Dugin does not in any way approach the only valid tradition, that being the Hyperborean Aryan, in doing so, as he attempts to politicize spirituality, which is not initiatic and thus is not a manifestation or rediscovery of the tradition, but is simply a vulgarization or profanation of the mysteries. Dugin goes further in his profanation by incorporating a heavy emphasis on chaos magic of a Crowleyan orientation, having been a devotee of Crowley and having been video recorded involving himself in various strange ritualistic action and pageantry involving various Crowleyan tropes. Hence the magical revival of Dugin is merely a lot of theater and shock value derived from an invented pseudo-religion Crowley called Thelema, a syncretic Magian form of magical praxis that is welded to Jewish plagiarized and hybridized Kabbalah. Whether any redeemable elements in this trundle sack of magic tricks exist is doubtful, that they can properly resonate with the souls of various subtypes of humanity, and indeed that they are not inextricably bound up with the same demonic forms that Crowley was fated to become destroyed by. Regardless, the chaos magic of Dugin is heavily Kabbalistic in the most Jewish sense of black magic, and thus is perhaps only an instrument of change within the system of contemporary modernity. The fact of Dugin's chaos magic serves as a stereotypically satanic other that such as Christians can point their finger at and condemn and be worked up into a frenzy to attack, thus serving the Jews' plans of orchestrating a Third World War. The Russian-Chinese phalanx is served up as Gog Magog on the silver platter of biblical prophecy as a Saturnian sacrifice of the new eon of the Age of Aquarius. This side plays Luciferian role of evil, with all manner of Luciferian and Saturnian iconography, the red, white and blue, of America constituting the Ido and Pingalanades and Shushumna of the occult anatomy, symbolizing man perfected perhaps, a Trinitarian conception of the dialectical reconciliation of opposites. This is the immanentization of the eschaton, with the legions of Lucifer leading both sides against one another in a final conflagration, tapping into the programming of the Abrahamic programs of Christianity and Islam and the Jews, whose monads derive from Saturn. According to Blavatsky, the secret doctrine being the mastermind controlling the dialectic of the black cube matrix, creating their idealized world order of the ages. Dugin's philosophy purports to be, and indeed may be, what could be called an organicist one, in which different Dasein, if that is the proper terminology or culture, souls are allowed to develop themselves through themselves and to have their own territorial region of the earth to facilitate the organic development of the culture organisms and souls which constitute those particular Dasein. It is a synthesis of Spenglerian and Jokian organicism and Heidegger, with elements of Crowleyan and other forms of chaos magic. The difficulty in understanding the consequences of this diamat or application of theory to practice is whether the Eurasianism of Dugin accommodates the preservation of racial groups, or simply their being placed into those geopolitical topoi or crucibles and melted down into alloys of various compatible or incompatible groups. That Dugin claims that race in the conventional sense is merely a lower aspect of beings, and that he employs an Evolan conception of race, implies that there may and also may not be the accommodation of racial preservation in his Noumakia theory, the multipolar conception of geopolitics in which the world is divided into cultural regions reflective of the ancestral traditions of various groups. If this is the consequence of such implementation, the writer sees no problem with the theory, which is largely consistent with karmic law, that being alive and let live policy to the extent deserved according to paleo and contemporary history. For each subgroup of what Dugin calls humanity, which, in spite of his conception being organicist, entails a humanist conception and thus is paradoxical in this respect if the writer properly understands his meaning. However, the means of equilibrizing the balance of the races, as was Crowley's intent, within the rubric of a solar phallic cult controlled by initiatic priest kings, Dugin seems to favor a conception of Luciferian androgyny, perhaps not meant physically but alchemically, though he has stated gender is a social construct and thus might be more willing to accommodate the gender-bending Luciferian type regardless of the typically deleterious social and psychological consequences of such characteristically low-minded behavior. Should this androgyny or unity consciousness be meant in a higher sense, of the balancing of the modalities of consciousness, the sacred feminine and the divine masculine, or the integration a la Miguel Serrano of the opposite gender of one's anatomical sex and a subordination and incorporation into the personality, this may be tolerable. Hence Dugin's organicist conception is one based upon karmic law, and though the utopian would misunderstand this as a perpetual peace, the latter may fail to understand that the law of life and the phenomenal world orients around will to power to a significant degree, and a war everlasting being the condition humane. Perhaps Dugin is being hubristic in attempting to create an equilibrious perpetual peace. The writer is not sufficiently informed of the end goal of this geopolitical strategy of Dugin's and how the balance of power would be established save through the aforementioned initiated priest kings, the Aryan race comprised of presumably a diversity of races or a hybrid stock. Such is unclear to the writer, but presumably they would, being a Brahmanical type, have the capacity to transcend their ego and work toward the evolutionary development of all mankind, however utopian this conception may be. This is critiqued in Mussolini and Gentiles, The Doctrine of Fascism, in reference to the self-determination of peoples, in a sarcastic tone by the ideologues of Italian fascism, which attempts to override this live-and-let-live principle and claims man can and must make his own world, especially with reference to Ethiopia and its conquest by the Italian fascists, who bucked the Judeo-Christian ethos of lions lying down with lambs and conquered the Lion of Judah, of the Falasha Jews of Ethiopia with the roar of Mene Frigo, casting away their sheepskins. Dugin is critical of both competing ideologies of the so-called extremes of the Overton window, the extreme left of Marxist communism and the extreme right of fascism and national socialism, and rejects both, as well as the comfortable bourgeois center of centrism, a cowardly compromise with both based upon material advantages and economics. Rather, Dugin posits is the fourth political theory beyond the centrist positions of democracy and the third positionism of right-wing fascism and national socialism and left-wing Marxist communism. This is a synthesis of elements of all of its forebears into a new mode or state in the dialectic and manifests itself in the multipolar theory that all cultures have their own Dasein and thus must self-determined in accordance with the laws of karma and evolution. What he neglects to mention is that the karma of the currently existing races has not been addressed by his live and let live philosophy, that each organism in its current form would qualify in the terminology of Jewish Kabbalah as klipoth save for the pure white races as all current subtypes of what Dugin calls humanity are hybrids. They in their culture amounts to a product of the murder of white men and the rape of white women or the voluntary fornication with non-white anthropoids and whites paleohistorically, their genetico-spiritual product amounting to a hybrid which is the race of today in all cases save the purest white races on this earth. Each and all have their karma in most cases save exceptions to the rule and thus are subject to karmic cycles as it relates to their culture organism in the Spengelrian sense. As an example, Blavatsky refers to how the Redskins' extinction is a karmic necessity owing to their genocidal destruction of the whites in the Americas from Atlantis who preceded the Redskins' presence in the Americas by over 7,500 years, having arrived 12,500 years ago creating Tiwanaku, Machu Picchu, Easter Island and various other pyramidal sites over the Americas and indeed the world. Hence the future of a whiter, brighter world is the promise of providence according to the laws of karma if and only if whites take their lucky chance full of meaning. This does not mean that all of the current stocks would be eliminated even in the case of the hegemony of the white race but would instead entail an upliftment perhaps of those favorably disposed in thought and deed toward the white race. Dugin of course would see it otherwise in his multipolar theory, who apparently supportive of otherness would simultaneously entail the possibility of Ben Klassen's conception of letting the muds wither on the vine, allowing them to go to their proper destiny. Once the non-whites attack the whites they incur their karma, through their own greed and self-seeking and receive their equal and opposite reaction. Thus Dugin's work may be a truly Brahmanical source of wisdom but that is difficult to definitively conclude or understand owing to the writer's poor acquaintance with his work. On the contrary, where the evidence related to Dugin's personal biography is consulted there is much that reveals the true sinister strategy of his fourth political theory, being little more than a contemporized version of the Kalergi plan for the formation of the Eurasian Negro as outlined decades before in Richard Kudenhove von Kalergi's practical idealism notorious Kalergi plan. The connections Dugin has are equally notorious in the worst sense of the word spanning the gamut of Jewish elites, working with rabbis, involving himself in Kabbalistic rituals and having affiliations with other Jews and other affiliates of Jews who are put forward by the Kabbalah's disinformation agents. Hence Dugin's suspicious character is blackened yet further. Indeed, the more one delves into Dugin the more he comes to understand this certainty of the role of propagandist and ideologue for the Kabbal to undermine the pro-white movement and subvert it by associating naive and gullible pro-white activists with Russia and Eurasianist policy as a means of setting them up through guilt by association as an enemy of the state, be they law-abiding or no, anyone critical of Jews, anyone pro-white, be they oblivious to Jews or no, and indeed anyone historically or contemporaneously having been disliked by Jews or representing a power source for whites, enabling them to consolidate power and strengthen themselves. The fourth political theory of Dugin and other similar works are the philosophical marketing gimmicks employed to sell Eurasianism, which softens up the white intelligentsia for receptivity to the expansion of the Russian Empire, which is Eurasian not white, the Russians having been predominantly Eurasian, a hybrid stock, and thus for the white Europeans filled with jealous hatred of their Hyperborean superiors. Dugin's plans are revealed in the book he had released over a decade prior to this point, which was designed for only Russian consumption, called The Foundations of Geopolitics, which vilifies whites and claims Russians are Finno-Tatar stock and not white. The plans of Dugin are for a Eurasian empire which would engulf Europe and destroy the ethnic stock therein through what Hitler called blood poisoning, enabling the mass immigration of Muslims and Orientals into Europe to mix the population out of existence. In concept, As spoken of in the fourth political theory, the multipolar conception outlined in his voluminous Numakia series, the idea of organicism where all regions will be respected and autonomous serves simply as a dupe of the white mind, a cleverly orchestrated deception that is intended to engineer the above results, the elimination of pro-white dissidents and easier takeover by Jewry as the hidden hand of the cabal. As such, Dugin is the glove puppet and front man of the cabal in the particular region and serves the cabal as one of the horns of its devilish dilemma it imposed upon the world, both of which are the enemies of Europe, as Yockey spoke of in his book of the same name, playing both faction against the ethnic population of the European Union, the white European Aryans, which is intended to be the reification of the Kalergi plan and the consummation of the genocide of the white race. All salesmen, disinformation agents who advertise the Dugenist Eurasian agenda are working toward the Kalergi plan's realization and serving the Jew. As such, they should be exposed and attacked. Further, as it concerns Dugin's philosophy, he puts forth a mother goddess orientation which is completely opposed to the historically Aryan conception of the solar Uranian worldview. Perhaps, as Dugin himself acknowledges with respect to the Demetrian solar of the Russian, this might apply to a greater extent to his Phinotatar stock, but has no place in the true Hyperborean tradition, which was always solar Uranian and hence a father god. This mother goddess religion is and has always been Jewish, having its origins paleo-historically, and which has carried itself forward in Dionysian rites and conceptions of Jewish Kabbalah, of which Dugin is a great fan. The mother goddess is the astral light and more or less accommodates the relationship between her consort and himself, between the initiate and the one, in the most dark occult sense of Luciferian atrocities perpetrated against others, transforming oneself into a being beyond good and evil, in Dionysiac ecstasis. Hence Dugin is way off the mark as to the Hyperborean tradition. The oft-cited counterexample of the Druids committing sacrifice in mass atrocities in the region Dugin justly speaks of as Hyperborea is not a legitimate example of Aryan stock, but was a case of Jewish infiltration into the priest caste and had imposed their typical sinister behavior on the population, a behavior bound up with their savage biology of Neanderthal reptilian blood, which represents the origin of the mother goddess religion on this earth and which is the insofar of the Jewish Kabbalah.